Welcome to Illinois Family Spotlight, a conversation about issues of the day from a biblical perspective, as well as highlights from interviews, conferences, and events. Here's Monty Larrick.
Thanks for making Illinois Family Spotlight part of your day. We're featuring remarks made by Nancy Piercy during the Illinois Family Institute's 2024 Recovering Biblical Manhood Worldview Conference held at the Village Church of Barrington. Ms. Piercy is a professor and scholar in residence at Houston Baptist University. Her insights for this edition of Spotlight are derived from her best-selling and critically acclaimed book, Love Thy Body.
We live in an age where public figures cannot say what a woman is. And by implication, of course, that means they cannot say what a man is. And I'm going to explain how we got to this point. It's part of a larger worldview shift, and I'm going to include abortion, homosexuality, and transgenderism. We tend to try to address each of these issues individually, right? Master the arguments on each issue. But it turns out we will be much more effective if we can grasp the underlying worldview that connects all of them. I was raised in a Lutheran home, and I don't know if you guys know this, but all Scandinavians are Lutheran. So my dad's Swedish, my mom's Norwegian. But the trouble with an ethnic background is sometimes there's less real personal faith. They rely on the ethnicity to hold you. And so I started asking questions in high school. I mean, I'm attending a public high school. All my teachers are secular. All my textbooks are secular. And actually, I had just one question, which was, how do we know Christianity is true? And unfortunately, none of the adults in my life could answer that. I talked to a Christian college professor and asked him point blank, why are you a Christian? He said, works for me. That's it. And then I had a chance to talk to a seminary dean, a Lutheran seminary dean, and I thought I would get a more substantial answer. And he said, don't worry, we all have doubts sometimes. Like it was a psychological phase. And so about halfway through high school, I made a very intentional decision. If I don't have good reasons for Christianity, I shouldn't say I believe it. You shouldn't say that about anything if you don't have good reasons. And I was not getting any good reasons. And so I went through several years as an agnostic. And that's how I actually got started studying philosophy. It was not an academic interest. It was like, I can't get any answers from the adults around me. So maybe these dead guys, these philosophers have answers, because isn't that their job, to ask questions like, what is truth? And how do we know it? And is there meaning to life? Is there a foundation for ethics? So it's just true for me, true for you. And I finally realized that there was no God. The answer was no to all of those. You know, there's no meaning to life. And it was several years later when I was living in Europe. I had lived there as a child. And so I had gone back. And that's how I kind of stumbled across Francis Schaeffer's ministry, Labri, which is in Switzerland. It's in the French-speaking part of Switzerland. And so Labri means the shelter. And I was blown away by this place. I had never encountered Christian apologetics before. I had no idea that Christianity could be supported by good reasons and arguments, and that it had answers to the secular isms that I had absorbed by that time. March 1971 was the first time I was there. And I actually didn't become a Christian the first time. I stayed for a month, and then I fled. I left. But because I discovered apologetics, and through Labri, I discovered Schaeffer. Osgoodness was on staff at the time. And just on my own, back in the States, just on my own through my own reading, I decided I was intellectually convinced it was true. And then I thought, where do I find other Christians? You know, I wasn't in a church or anything. So I thought, well, I knew some back at Labri. So I went back a year and a half later. I went back to Labri and stayed for 4 months. And that's where I really got grounded in Christian worldview. And that's why everything I do now is apologetics. All my teaching, all my writing has something to do with apologetics, because I really want to answer for young people who have the same questions that I had at that time. But I've put together the most common questions that I get on podcasts, radio programs, and so on. And actually, we just covered my first question. My first question is, tell us about yourself. But the second question is, you know, so you write about apologetics, but the problem is that the questions have changed. People are no longer asking, is Christianity true? They're asking, why are Christians such bigots? So the question is then, how do you answer that? Well, what I do is I turn the tables. I show that it's actually the secular or atheist view that is harmful and negative and dehumanizing. Why? Because it has a negative view of the dignity and value of the human body. Let me give you an example. It's easiest if we just jump in. So start with abortion. A few years ago, an article appeared by a British broadcaster who said she had always been proudly pro-choice until she became pregnant with her own baby. And then she began to struggle. She writes, "I was calling the life inside me a baby because I wanted it. But if I hadn't wanted it, I would think of it as just a group of cells that it was okay to kill." To her credit, she realized that didn't make sense. A fetus doesn't become a baby just because somebody wants it. And so she began to research the subject. She even did a documentary on it. And after several months, she reached this conclusion. She said, "In terms of science, I have to agree that life begins at conception. But in terms of moral rights or moral status, perhaps the fact of life is not what's important. It's whether the life has grown enough to start becoming a person." So you see, what has happened here to the concept of the human being has been split in two. If you could be human life at one point, but not a person until sometime later, then clearly these are two different things. And this is a radically divided, fractured, dualistic view of what it means to be a human being. And philosophers often use the metaphor of two stories in a building. Those of you who are familiar with Schaeffer know where I got this. He talked about how the concept of truth itself has been split. But if truth has been split, it applies to every other field, including ethics. How it applies to ethics is this way, a metaphor of two stories in a building. In the lower story is science. And most professional bioethicists today agree that in terms of science, life begins at conception. The fetus is biologically, genetically, physiologically human. The evidence from science is just too strong to deny it. But if they want to support abortion, how do they get around that? They argue that merely being human is not enough for legal protection. The fetus has to earn the right to life by becoming a person, which is typically defined in terms of mental abilities, a certain level of self-awareness, consciousness, cognitive functioning, and so on. So what secular bioethicists are saying is that even though the fetus is biologically human, that's not enough for human dignity and rights. It can be killed for any reason or no reason. It can be used for research and experiments. It can be tinkered with genetically. It can be picked through for sellable body parts and then tossed out with the other medical waste. And that's exactly how medical journals describe the fetus body after an abortion, medical waste. So being human no longer confers any sort of dignity or value. It's called personhood theory. And what's the most obvious problem with it? If you separate personhood from biology, nobody can agree on how to define it. So some people say, well, yeah, of course the fetus becomes a person sometime before birth. But there are people today who say no, not until after birth. The two scientists who discovered the double helix structure of DNA, Crick and Watson, have both gone on record saying we should give every newborn 3 days of genetic testing, and only if it passes the test do we call it a person. The idea being that some deformities don't show up until after birth, and the parents should have the right to kill the child after birth. Peter Singer is an ethics professor at Princeton University, and on his website, he says even 3 years of age is a gray area. How much cognitive functioning does a toddler have? So what's the lesson? The lesson is when the concept of personhood is separated from biology, it becomes completely arbitrary. There's no objective criteria. Which functions count? How developed do they have to be in order to count? And every bioethicist ends up drawing the line at a different place, depending on their own private views and values. Nothing objective about it. See, what's happened is supporters of abortion lost the argument at the scientific level, and so they've shifted to the non-scientific, non-empirical, subjective concept of personhood. So it's time to turn the tables. When personhood is rooted in biology, then we have a marker of human status that is objective and empirically testable, something we can identify scientifically. So today it is Christians who are pro-science, who value human life, including at the biological level. The next question I often get is this. Now, the most surprising thing about your book, Love Thy Body, is you claim that there's a common thread, a worldview thread, underlying these issues of, like, abortion, euthanasia, and questions of sexuality and gender. Explain that. The common thread is that division of the person from the body. Let's take the hookup culture. Its entire premise is sex can be purely physical, cut off from the whole person. In Love Thy Body, I include lots of poignant quotes from college students, like Alicia, who says, "Hookups are very scripted. You learn to turn everything off except your body. You make yourself emotionally invulnerable." Another college student who was interviewed in Rolling Stone magazine said, The mistake people make is they assume there are two very distinct elements in a relationship, one emotional and one sexual, and they pretend like there are clean lines between them, where the body is separate from the self. Christians sometimes say that the hookup culture gives sex too much importance, but in reality, it gives sex too little importance. So you see, once again, the secular worldview is saying that the body has no meaning or value or significance. And no wonder the hookup culture is creating a trail of wounded people. People are trying to live out a secular ethic that does not fit who they really are. A college psychologist said the two most prescribed medications on the college campus today are birth control pills and antidepressants. And that's not a coincidence. The Christian ethic is incarnational, right? The most complete and intimate physical union is meant to express the most complete and intimate union of the whole person in the whole life commitment of marriage. And science is on our side. Science has shown that the interconnection of body and person with the discovery of hormones like oxytocin and vasopressin, these are called the bonding hormones because they create a sense of attachment and trust. A UCLA psychiatrist says, "You might say we were designed to bond." That's something you expect from a UCLA psychiatrist. Scripture teaches that human beings are embodied spirits. Embodied spirits, and they're both integral parts of our identity. And it comes out beautifully in the parallelism of Hebrew poetry. "My soul thirsts for you, my flesh yearns for you." Our soul has sent down into the dust, our body cleaves to the earth. "Keep my words in the midst of your heart, for they are life to those who find them and health to all their body." You see, the inner life of the soul is expressed through the outer life of the body. The body shares in the dignity, value, and significance of the whole person. Okay, the next question, not surprisingly, typically gets into more controversial territory. What about homosexuality? Once again, the secular ethic divides the body from the person and devalues the body. Think of it this way. Even my homosexual friends agree that on the level of biology, physiology, anatomy, chromosomes, males and females are counterparts to one another. That is how the human sexual and reproductive system is designed. To embrace a same-sex identity is to implicitly contradict that design. It's to say, why should the structure of my biology, my biological sex as male or female, have any say in my moral choices? We have to help people to see that this is a profoundly disrespectful view of the body. It pits the mind against the body and says it's only the mind and feelings that count. Now, some people argue that if sexual orientation is rooted in our genes, then they are being true to their biology. But there's no conclusive proof of a biological cause. We can cite the APA, the American Psychological Association. On its website, it says, "No findings have emerged that permit scientists to conclude that sexual orientation is determined by any particular factor," and they've looked at both genetic and social factors. In fact, research has found that about 80% of people who come out as homosexual change their sexual identity label at least once, right? Back to heterosexual, bisexual, queer, and other things. 80% change their sexual identity label at least once, which means for many people it's more than once. That does not sound like a trait that is biologically determined. A magazine called The New Scientist said, "It's time to get past born this way." In religious circles, it's sometimes said that God made some people gay. Right? You've heard that. You know, God made me gay. But I met a former homosexual. He's now married to a woman. You have to say that now. Married to a woman and has three children. And he said this, "If God makes some people gay, wouldn't that make God a cruel God? Because it would mean that he has engineered their minds and emotions for attraction to the same sex, but he's created their physiology to be in direct opposition to that attraction. Would God create people to be torn in two conflicting directions?" In the Christian worldview, things like conflict, self-division, self-alienation are the results of the fall, not creation. Today, however, in the secular world, it's widely accepted that if somebody has that conflict between mind and body, it's the mind that counts, right? Your feelings and desires. So what should our response be? Once again, we could ask, why should we accept such a demeaning view of the body? The Christian ethic is holistic. Our mind and emotions are meant to be in tune with our body. It's an ethic that overcomes self-alienation. It leads to a sense of internal unity and wholeness. In a real interview, I have to sometimes stop and let the radio host get a word in edgewise.
Author and educator Nancy Piercy, during the Illinois Family Institute's Recovering Biblical Manhood Worldview Conference held at the Village Church of Barrington. More of her comments from that special event after this.
Hi, this is Pastor Kelvin from Christian Liberty Academy in Arlington Heights. It is time to get your children and grandchildren out of the godless government schools. How can we subject our loved ones to forced, ungodly psychological examinations and perverse sexual teachings? You would not send your child to a school that teaches 2 + 2 = 5. What is being taught today is far worse and damaging to minds and hearts. We can help through our on-campus Christian school and homeschool program. For over 55 years, we have operated a Christian school now in Arlington Heights, and we have served hundreds of thousands of families across our nation and foreign countries through our homeschool program, Christian Liberty Homeschools. Visit ChristianLiberty.com to learn more or to schedule a tour of our excellent 12-acre facility. Take action today. Visit ChristianLiberty.com, ChristianLiberty.com.
Join Allie Beth Stuckey and the Illinois Family Institute for the Faith, Family, and Freedom Banquet, 7 p.m. Friday, September 6th at the Tinley Park Convention Center. For tickets, go to IllinoisFamily.org.
Christianity brings civilization, goodness.
Allie Beth Stuckey, wife, mom, author, followed by thousands on her hit Relatable podcast. Hear her fresh and firm call for Christians to lead in Illinois, in America, for faith, family, and freedom. For tickets, go to IllinoisFamily.org.
Christians have always been on the front lines of human progress, set in love.
Allie Beth Stuckey and the Illinois Family Institute's Faith, Family, and Freedom Banquet, Friday, September 6th at the Tinley Park Convention Center. For tickets, go to IllinoisFamily.org, IllinoisFamily.org. Thanks for joining Illinois Family Spotlight. We're highlighting remarks made by author and educator Nancy Piercy during the Illinois Family Institute's 2024 Recovering Biblical Manhood Worldview Conference held at the Village Church of Barrington. In this segment, Ms. Piercy explains how the state is redefining parenthood without regard to biology. And she also explains how God calls us to love our bodies.
The next question often is, one of the most surprising things about your book, your claim is that a secular worldview denigrates or demeans the body? Right. If a person does not believe in God and thinks that the physical world is all that exists, you would expect him to think the physical body is really important. But surprisingly, it's the opposite. And the reason is that the secular ethic derives from the theory that nature is a product of blind, purposeless forces, and therefore the human body has no intrinsic purpose that we're morally obligated to respect. Listen to an outspoken lesbian who explains this. Her name is Camille Paglia. Do some of you know Camille Paglia? Christians sometimes read her stuff because she's a bit of an iconoclastic feminist. She does not think sex is just a social construction. No. She says, nature made us male and female. Here's how she puts it. Our sexual bodies are designed for reproduction. You catch that word, designed? A bit odd for an atheist. By the way, she's now trans, not just a lesbian, she's transgender. But the question is, if nature made us male and female, how does she justify being either lesbian or trans? Here's how she explains it. Well, why not defy nature? After all, fate, not God, has given us this flesh. We have absolute claim to our bodies, do with them as we see fit. So do you see the logic? If our bodies are a product of mindless, purposeless forces, then they have no intrinsic purpose. They convey no moral message. They give us no clue to our identity. We may do with them as we see fit. They give no clue to our identity. So in the news now, you will see stories of kids who come home from first grade saying, my teacher says just because you have boy parts doesn't mean you're a boy. Just because you have girl parts doesn't mean you're a girl. So your body is meaningless. It tells you nothing. But what does the Bible teach? It says the world was created for a purpose. And science is on our side again. It's evident to observation that living things are structured for a purpose, that eyes are for seeing, ears are for hearing, fins are for swimming, wings are for flying. In fact, the development of the entire organism is directed by an inbuilt plan, a blueprint, right? DNA. So science itself tells us that nature exhibits a design, a plan, an order, a purpose. And as Christians, what we're saying is you will be happier and healthier when you live according to that built-in purpose. In Love Thy Body, I give lots of stories. Don't think of it as just, you know, moral arguments. There's lots and lots of stories, especially now that I teach at a university. I get lots of stories from my students, which is great fun. John, as a young man, he identified as exclusively homosexual. Today, he's married to a woman and has three kids. And by the way, he's also a Christian ethics professor in London. What's interesting about his story is he was raised in a gay-affirming family and attended a gay-affirming church. Some people will say, well, if you walk away from homosexuality, you're driven by self-loathing and shame. He says, no, I didn't think there was anything wrong with it. So why did he change? He says, I came to regard my body as who I was. And here's how he puts it. As a man, I realized that God's original intention for me in creation was to be able to relate sexually to a woman. And this remained true quite irrespective of whatever feelings I might have. And so he says, I didn't try to change my feelings directly, which rarely works. Instead, my goal was to accept or acknowledge what I already had, which was a male body, as a good gift from God. And eventually my feelings started to follow suit. So he didn't defy nature. Instead, he accepted his body as fundamentally good and a source of identity, as a good gift from God. And that's really the question at the core of this debate. Do we live in a cosmos operating by blind material forces, or a cosmos designed by a loving creator, which is therefore intrinsically good? Not surprisingly, the follow-up question is often about the other cutting-edge issue of our day, which is transgenderism. What's the worldview driving the trans movement? It's the same worldview, the same devaluing of the body. Transgender activists argue explicitly that your gender identity has nothing to do with your physical body, your biological sex. A BBC documentary says at the heart of the debate is the idea that your mind can be at war with your body. In that war, it's the mind that wins. Another BBC video features a young woman who identifies as non-binary, telling teenagers, it doesn't matter what living meat skeleton you've been born in, it's what you feel that defines you. So your body's been reduced to a meat skeleton. Jessica Silvano is a male-to-female transsexual who created a Kickstarter page for a documentary titled, I Am Not My Body. That title pretty much says it all, right? The claim is your body is not part of your authentic self. And once again, do you see how this leads to this fractured, fragmented, divided view of the human being? Your biological identity, and it's totally separate from your gender identity. A Princeton professor wrote what I think was the first book defending transgenderism on an academic level. So, of course, I have to read that because what the academics say is what filters down eventually. And what's fascinating is this professor admitted that transgenderism involves disconnect, disjunction, self-division, self-estrangement. I thought, this is a defense? Sounds like a critique. This was the core of her position, though. What the real body, that is the physical body, tells us is nothing. It has no meaning at all. This is the heart of what schools are teaching young people today, that their bodies have no meaning at all, gives them no sense of identity. And again, what should our response be? Why accept such a demeaning view of the body? I read an interview with a 14-year-old girl who was a detransitioner. She had transitioned to male identity at age 11 and lived as a trans boy for 3 years, and then at age 14 reclaimed her identity as a girl. Here's what she said in the interview. The turning point came when I realized it's not conversion therapy to learn to love your body. The interview came out too late for me to include in my book. But what a great quote for a book titled Love Thy Body. Even secular people are starting to say the transgender movement expresses body hatred. What this means is that Christians have a wonderful opportunity to show that a biblical ethic is based on loving the body. It expresses a positive view of the way God made us as physically embodied beings. The biological connection between male and female is not some evolutionary accident. It's part of the original creation that God pronounced very good. Okay, here's your next question. I always get this question, but people always say, what about intersex people? Is that the same thing as trans? The answer is no. The word intersex refers to a condition where a person's reproductive anatomy is atypical or anomalous due to a malfunction in their genes and hormones. Now, transgender activists often use the existence of intersex people to argue that there's not just male and female, but there's a spectrum in between. But is that true? No. There's still only two gametes, the sperm and egg. The sperm and egg, there's no spectrum in between, and that's what makes you male or female. People with intersex conditions should not be used as a political football by people who want to deconstruct the male-female binary. When I was writing my book, Love Thy Body, I was actually contacted by an intersex woman. She'd heard somehow that I was writing this book. And here's what she said to me. How do you think it feels being a pawn in someone else's game? It hurts to be shoved into the LGBT camp by either side. So let's talk about some practical strategies. What do we do if someone in our church or family or school or medical practice identifies as gay or trans? In Love Thy Body, I tell the story of a young woman named Jean who lived as a lesbian for several years and now is married to a man and has two children. What was the turning point for Jean? She has this wonderful quote. She said, I finally came to trust that God had made me female for a reason, and I wanted to honor my body by living in accord with the Creator's design. So strategy number one is to use positive language. Honor my body. Live in accord with the Creator's design. Respect your biological sex. Live in tune with who God made you to be. Let's face it, Christians are often known for using negative language, right? It's morally wrong, it's a sin, it's against the Bible, and there's something wrong with you. And there's some truth to that, but the way to win people's hearts is if we learn to communicate a positive message that their body is God's creation, and a biblical ethic shows us how to honor and respect it. By the way, this is what I find to be the hardest thing. I put this first in my strategies because I found this is the hardest thing for Christians to get their mind around. They're so used to saying, it's a sin, it's wrong, don't do it. But the message should be, as Christians, we want you to love your body, to honor your body, to live in accord with the Creator's design. Secondly, we can be proactive. Studies have found that the strongest correlate of both same-sex attraction and gender dysphoria, far stronger than any genetic link, is simply childhood gender nonconformity, which means kids who behave in ways that are the more stereotypical of the opposite sex. I'll give you just one quote from the academic literature. One study found that childhood gender nonconforming behavior is a consistent early predictor of future non-heterosexual orientations. In Love Thy Body, I tell the story of a boy I call Brandon, not his real name, who did suffer from gender dysphoria from a very young age. By the way, the classic version of gender dysphoria was usually male. It was called transsexualism back then, and it usually did start quite young. So this was a classic case. Before he was even walking, his babysitter said to his mother, he's too good to be a boy, by which she meant he's gentle and quiet and compliant, the things we normally associate with girls. When he was in preschool and his mother picked him up every day, he was playing with the little girls and not the little boys. By elementary school, he was coming to his parents weeping repeatedly, saying, I feel the way girls do. I'm interested in the things girls are. God should have made me a girl. By his early teens, he was scouring the internet for information on sex reassignment surgery. So what did his parents do? First, they made sure that he knew they loved him just the way he was. They did not try to change him. They told him it's perfectly acceptable to be a gentle, sensitive, relational boy. It does not mean you're really a girl. His parents said it may mean that God has gifted you for one of the caring professions, as a psychologist or counselor or healthcare worker. And of course, by the same token, perfectly acceptable for a girl to be gender nonconforming, to be more assertive or interested in STEM subjects. Brandon's parents' favorite line was, it's not you that's wrong, it's the stereotypes that are wrong. The upshot is he did not transition. Many kids accept their biological sex in puberty, right? He did not really accept his male identity until his early 20s. He was a pretty serious case. In all of these issues, people often ask, well, how do other people's choices affect you? Why let them live the way they want? And the answer is that when laws are changed, that affects everyone. And so because this is a policy-oriented group, I don't always include this section, but for you guys, I want to include this, how these issues have been affected in the laws. A free society is possible only if it recognizes that some rights are pre-political. That means the state does not create them. The state merely recognizes them as pre-existing. So take abortion. The right to life is the most fundamental of all. Like, it's the right not to be killed. The state did not create that right. It's a right you have just because you're a member of the human race. But the only way that the state could legalize abortion was to rule that the fetus is human but not a legal person unless it meets certain criteria, which means that when states pass laws against allowing abortion, the state has basically claimed the authority to decide which humans qualify as persons, based not on biology, but only on its own legal fiat. Do you see that? The denigration of biology is now instantiated in the law that you're biologically human, but who cares? You don't have any rights on that basis. Marriage is a pre-political right based on the fact that men and women naturally come together to form families. Humans are a sexually reproducing species. But the only way the state could treat same-sex couples the same as opposite-sex couples was to deny the biological component of marriage, to redefine it as a purely emotional commitment. That's what the Supreme Court did in the Obergefell decision legalizing same-sex marriage. The problem with that is that we have lots of emotional connections. So who decides which ones qualify as marriage? The state has claimed the right to define which relationships qualify as marriage, based not on the facts of biology, but only on its own say-so. Right? The biological connection between male and female no longer counts as a basis for marriage. Parenthood. Up until now, who counts as the child's legal parents was based on biological relationship. The woman who gives birth is the mother, but her legal husband was presumed to be the child's biological father. This was called the presumption of parentage. But in same-sex couples, at least one partner is not biologically related to the child. Until recently, that partner's name did not go on the birth certificate. They could adopt, of course, but same-sex parents wanted to be treated exactly like opposite-sex parents. Anything else they said was discriminatory. And in a 2017 decision, the Supreme Court agreed. It said, if a same-sex couple is legally married, then the same-sex spouse who is not biologically related gets the presumption of parentage. So essentially, the state has claimed authority to redefine parenthood without regard to biology. Biology no longer counts. In principle, parenthood is now treated as something created by the state. You are your child's parent if the state says you are. Until recently, gender identity followed naturally, organically from your biological sex. But the only way the law can treat a transgender woman, which means a biological male, the same as a biological woman was to say biology is irrelevant. And in the 2020 Bostock decision, the court agreed. It said that sex in Title VII really means gender. So the law no longer recognizes your biological sex, it only recognizes the gender, whatever you claim it to be. So what's the principle in all these cases? Many of our pre-political rights are rooted in biology. And when the law no longer recognizes biology, the state is claiming the right to redefine those rights. So the sexual revolution is dramatically increasing the power of the state. So I would just end with a story now. A woman named Laura Perry. Some of you know Laura Perry? She's written a book now. She transitioned to a male identity and successfully passed as a male for 10 years. Then she started transcribing Bible studies for her mother. So she started reading scripture, and she became a Christian. And at first, she thought she could continue living as a man. She said, I aspired to be a real man of God. But one day while she was praying, she seemed to hear God say to her, you cannot claim to love me and yet reject my creation. And she knew what that meant, right? You cannot reject your body, your biological identity. So today she is living as a woman. So what is the answer to the secular worldview on all of these issues of gender and sexuality? It's to build a Christian culture that loves God and loves his creation. So the good news is not only salvation, the good news is creation. Right, that God created you, body and soul, soul and body, and that he does call you to love your body. Thank you very much.
Author and educator Nancy Piercy, during the Illinois Family Institute's 2024 Worldview Conference held at the Village Church of Barrington. Please support the work of the Illinois Family Institute. All donations are tax deductible. If you'd like to give, click Donate on the IllinoisFamily.org homepage or call 708-781-9328. Be sure to sign on for IFI email updates at IllinoisFamily.org and go there to check for upcoming events and educational resources. Tell your family and friends about Illinois Family Spotlight. And until next time, stay healthy, stay active, and God bless.
For more information about Illinois Family Spotlight, visit ifiaction.org. And to email questions and comments, do so at feedback@ifiaction.org.